Kentik is cloud observability for network nerds, unifying hybrid and multi-cloud network telemetry so you can optimize cost and security at scale.
Not to mention, Kentik AI is available for you to easily access all that data without even needing to learn KQL or spin up your Elk stack.
Find out more at the break.
Packet pushers.
Welcome to Day 2 DevOps, where the DevOps is in the details. I'm Ned Bellavance, and on Day 2 DevOps, we explore those details and how you can learn from the mistakes of others and build a solid DevOps practice on Day 1 and beyond. With me on this journey of learning and doing is my co-host, Kyler Middleton. Hi, Kyler.
Hi, Ned, and hello, cool humans. Today's a special episode as we finish out the year where we partner up with Drew Conrad Murray, and it was supposed to be JJ Manella, but they are dealing with some personal stuff. They're sorting out their family, so good luck to them. I hope everything works out. They host the cybersecurity-focused podcast, Packet Protector, to talk about the previous year's major developments in cloud security and DevOps, and then we'll make some wild predictions for what's coming in 2025. During this conversation, we're going to talk about, has serverless peaked? Why is Kubernetes still so hard? I thought it was supposed to make my life easier. Cloud repatriation, are we all just moving back into our data centers? And the role sprawl of DevOps. It was just supposed to be the overlap, and now it feels like, is it join union, I think, where it's everything together? It just feels like it gets bigger and bigger, and it's just an impossibly large role. So with no further ado, let's get to it.
Drew, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you on. Before we get into the topic at hand, why don't you tell the good listeners a little more about your podcast, Packet Protector?
Hey, Ned. Hey, Kyler. Thank you for having me on. This is going to be fun. Yeah, I co-host Packet Protector with Jennifer JJ Manella. We tag it as the podcast at the intersection of networking and security. And we talk about all things networking and security. We do some news. We also get into issues around security. We just released a recent episode on personal privacy tools. We've got an episode coming up on cyber insurance and how that works. We get into stuff like firewalls, cloud firewalls, pretty much everything you could think of. And again, with that focus on people working at the intersection of those two disciplines, networking and security.
And since one podcast would never be enough, you also co-host the Network Break podcast. And that might be a little more germane to today's conversation because we're going to be asking you questions about what's happening in the news. And that's what Network Break covers, right?
Yeah, Network Break is a weekly IT news show. I co-host that with Jonna Johnson, who is a very smart person. She runs Nemertes Consulting, and they do a lot of industry research and talk to interesting people. So she's always got a great take on the IT news of the week.
Always helps me fill in the gaps of news that I missed. So that's a weekly listen for me.
And not to throw shadow on Chaos Lover, of course.
We do our own thing too. Yes. Wow. We all have too many podcasts and projects. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the first topic is around serverless, because I remember serverless was really popular and exciting, what, 6-7 years ago? Has it peaked? What are your thoughts, Drew?
Well, I guess my initial thought is yes, because I just really don't hear about it anymore. Because my focus is generally networking, security, a little bit of cloud, sort of what's top of mind in the industry kind of reaches me through various channels. I haven't heard about serverless in ages. A while ago, it did seem to be like the new hotness, a new way to streamline your infrastructure deployments even more, get things done faster. And then the last couple of years, I just haven't heard much about it. I assumed it was sort of trucking along and people who needed it used it and everybody else was like, yeah, whatever. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's kind of a mature technology. And so it's not the new hotness anymore. It's just a tool in our arsenal. We're hearing more of this narrative that we will still have servers. For a while, that was the narrative, right? There's no more servers.
Right.
Serverless is coming. You won't have to manage Windows anymore. It's all going to be great. But now it seems it's just a mature technology. And it's certainly one with its own pitfalls. It's not a perfect technology. You can accidentally spend tens of thousands of dollars on a looping Lambda script. And it never became, in the same way that maybe like Kubernetes, I'm jumping the shark for our future topic of Kubernetes, became like a standard tool that works everywhere. It never became that. Lambda never became something that existed outside of AWS. Like it never became, there is a tool that'll work anywhere for serverless. It's always, you have to learn it on this cloud. And then if you move to another cloud, you have to learn it there too.
The problem we had with serverless, if we're thinking about functions as a service, because serverless encompasses more than just that. My definition of serverless, or at least the one that I've heard, is the ability to scale down to zero and have an almost instantaneous scale up from nothing on demand, and that you don't have to manage the underlying infrastructure that runs that service, whatever it is. So it doesn't have to be a function, but the most common example people bring up is Lambda. And if AWS had chosen to go with a non-proprietary implementation, I think we could have seen much larger adoption of serverless across the industry. But instead, they chose to kind of cook their own thing. And then Azure wandered along and they're like, well, we're going to cook our own thing. And Google, they already had AppRun, I think is what their service is called, that is able to run a container or a serverless function, essentially. And they were like, yeah, we're going to do our own thing too. And so you didn't have this consistency across the three big clouds. And then Kubernetes kind of kicked in the door and was like, what's up, everybody? I'm here. I can run random containers and functions too. And so we had the open functions as a service project that existed, but it had its own competitor in Kubernetes. So there was confusion in the marketplace there too. I think it was called Knative. So all these different projects all kind of happening at the same time. And I think people picked and choose where it worked for them. And to a certain degree, containers on Kubernetes kind of also fulfills that same need while being a standard interface that works across everything.
I swear it's a tool that's not as fit for purpose as like a Lambda function, but it certainly is more standard. And so if I'm going to spend my time learning something, I want a tool that's going to work across clouds, right?
Absolutely. That is probably the number one driving factor is it worth me learning this new technology if I can only apply it to this one corner case? Or do I learn this much broader technology that is being used everywhere? And is it the perfect fit? No, but it's more broadly applicable. So I'm not like boxing myself in by becoming a Lambda expert.
Do you two feel like serverless is sort of the last redoubt of proprietary cloud, like a holdout? Because we are seeing a lot more multi-cloud adoption and people finding ways to make cloud services work across multiple platforms.
I think that's a really good question. I think it's more of a granular kind of scale. I don't think it's a binary check here because all of these cloud providers benefit hugely by locking you in. Yeah. So as much as they can make it look like something that isn't proprietary, hello, EKS and AKS, but make it absolutely proprietary to how their thing works, like, you know, the Fargates of the world, they will continue to do so because they benefit from that in a huge way. And that's not to knock them. They're making life easier. They're building out on these tools, but they're building them out in a way that puts you in a cage. It puts the lock on.
Yeah. And that frustration expands to all kinds of services across the clouds. Networking is different on all three clouds. Even though we have networking standards and we could have just developed a standard for virtual private networking, no. And then identity and access management, vastly different across the three clouds, totally different constructs. You couldn't even make them the same.
Mm-hmm. And so complex, by the way, the things they invented are so complex that you need a specialty in it to understand what's happening. IAM is its own language and it goes wrong all the time.
Oh my goodness. And then like the thing that should have been the easiest, like the slam dunk, VMs and storage, like we could have standardized on those too. And it's like, no, we're going to use our own object store API instead of the S3. And that S3 should have just become the industry standard across all the cloud providers. Everybody just uses the same verbs and uses the same API, and they didn't. And if there's one thing that frustrates me to no end, it's like we have standards and we know that standards make things easier for engineers. But it's really not in the cloud's best interest to embrace standards when they can instead put up that proprietary lock-in. And that's what we've seen across all the major public clouds. I feel like the newer ones that are rolling in are less likely to do that, but in part because they don't have the clout to force people into their weird proprietary thing.
And S3 notably is an open standard now. AWS has released it and encouraged it and starting to get adopted, but I just think it's too late, you know?
I guess I won't say I'm happy to hear this, but it's familiar territory from the networking realm where protocols are supposed to work together, but you know, ask an engineer to get MLAG from two different vendors to work together and you will run into all kinds of hairy issues. So we've continued to duplicate the same problems in every new environment.
Oh, I love that you pulled out MLAG because I tried getting HP switching to talk to Cisco over MLAG once and just an exercise in futility.
Mm-hmm. All of the Cisco books that I read for certifications were like, here's the open source one and then here's our acronym for the same thing, but ours has a couple more tweaks that are better. That's and right. It's like, okay, well, now I have to learn two things. Thank you. Uh-huh. It's the XKCD comic after all. We wanted to solve the standard problem, so we made a new standard and now we have to learn both.
Yep. We have ways to move into some of the other topics here. Maybe the next one that I want to move into is Kubernetes, because we mentioned it several times. And Kyler, I think this was your question. Mm-hmm. Why is Kubernetes still so complex and hard to build and manage? I feel like you have strong opinions about this right out of the gate. So
yeah. I do. So Kubernetes has been around for a while. Google released it, what, in 2010-ish, 2012-ish, something like that. And it was this wonderful cloud transforming technology. And there was always that note that, like, there's going to be some rough edges. It's a new technology. It's evolving. And here we are almost 15 years later. And I swear, it's all rough edges. That's all I can find. And I know there's all of these wonderful tools that are built into it and it's evolving, but it sure seems like it is still just as full of edges that are going to cut you as it was 15 years ago when it was dropped. And maybe that's just my limited experience here, but it is so complicated in my experience to run it. I have this list of tools that I've had to learn to manage Kubernetes clusters at work, and it's EKS, in AKS, which are distinct from Kubernetes. They have their own implementations and their own tool sets. Customize, Argo CD, Helm, Flux, Rancher, and Crossplane in order to run a VM, in order to run a container. And like, I could do this in ECS 10 years ago and it would take like a couple of Terraform resources. I don't know, what happened, guys? What happened here?
I mean, I guess my first question is, who profits from that complexity? Do you have a sense?
Not me.
Yeah, not you.
I think what we're seeing is not so much a problem with Kubernetes, the project itself. That has remained fairly focused on its goals of scheduling workloads. Mm-hmm. I think what we've seen is the explosion of tools around it to solve for various use cases. So you mentioned like Customize and Helm, mm-hmm. and those are largely deployment tools to get your application to run on Kubernetes. Argo CD is the same thing. It's a tool that once your application is deployed, how do you customize it? And it works with Customize to do that. So we have a lot of like open source tools that are being cobbled together. If someone introduced you to Linux for the very first time and was like, okay, so you're gonna need to know how to use these 26 different tools in Linux to manage your system, you like tear your hair out.
Yeah. So how much do you know about window managers? Which window manager? I don't care. I want it to work. Everyone needs Windows. What are you talking about?
Exactly. And I think it's a similar sort of situation where because Kubernetes itself is open source and almost all the tooling for it is open source, we get this tool sprawl. I mean, all you have to do is look at the CNCF landscape and mm-hmm. go, oh, there's all these things. But the thing is, you can pick and choose which projects make the most sense to you. And Kubernetes has been around for 10 years. They actually celebrated the 10-year anniversary earlier this year. I remember seeing a lot of things on the social medias about it. That makes it still a very new and immature technology. And it also means that the tooling around it is still relatively new and relatively immature. It has definitely gotten better. I think some of the sharp corners have been rounded out a little bit and sanded down. But at the end of the day, it's still a complex ecosystem. And so it's a lot to wrap your brain around. I don't see that going away anytime soon. But if you really hate it, you can just pay somebody else to manage it for you.
Kyler, you mentioned VMs. Do you feel like Kubernetes is, you know, sort of miles away from the complexity that grew up around hypervisors?
I think so. Yeah. And this is maybe my age showing through that I used VMware when it was a relatively mature product. I think it was 3.0 or 3.5 when I joined. So there was already like virtual networking that would extend to different stacks. And cloud was so nascent, at least where I was at, that we were using multiple clusters of VMs that worked pretty well. Like, I don't remember having to like learn a whole new networking standard. They pretty much worked with like an MLAG to a Cisco switch and the Cisco Nexus Core, and it like just kind of worked. And in Kubernetes, we're bifurcating the network, we're bifurcating the controls, we have different tools to manage it instead of this cool GUI where I can make a golden image and deploy it. It just seems a lot harder. I don't know, maybe that's my experience and my tooling, or maybe it's different.
When VMware introduced NSX, networking went from being a relatively simple and straightforward thing to integrate with VMware. I mean, it's still complex. There were still things, and especially if you were coming from the sysadmin side, like you were trying to learn all this networking terminology to ask your poor networking team to add trunked VLANs. Mm-hmm. They're like, why do you need trunked VLANs on this port? Like, trust me. NSX made networking like 12 times more complex. And that carried right over into Kubernetes because we're trying to virtualize and add another layer of totally separate networking on top of the existing network. VMware at least was a singular company that had a vision and was able to put tooling in front of people that were used to clicking around in a GUI. Kubernetes doesn't have that. And there's like 12 different network plugins you can use for the CNI portion of things. And they don't have the pretty GUIs, because if you're not doing things at the CLI with Kubernetes, what are you even doing?
So you're saying it's time for the renaissance of VMware. VMware, if you're listening, please create the GUI for Kubernetes and we can just plug that in and I can go back to using VMware for everything. And it was easy. I miss it.
Didn't they try that? They had something that was supposed to help you run VMs and Kubernetes side by side. I'm missing the brand name in my head, but
they still do have it.
Yes.
And it was named after a tree or something. And it's going to come to me in a moment.
But Ned, I think you raise an interesting point, is that what Kubernetes is meant for is orchestrating a bunch of containers, but those containers don't just sort of live by themselves. You need to attach other things to it. Networking, identity and access control, ingress and egress, policy, all that stuff. That's where maybe the complexity starts to come in, because it's not just about individual container orchestration. It's you have to tie this into a larger and more complex system. So maybe it's less about Kubernetes and more about just modern operations.
It's kind of like a cloud built by committee. I don't want to knock the CNCF too much. I feel like I'm being really mean at the CNCF, because I know that they're building incredible tools in this wide diaspora of like developers. But it's like a cloud in a cloud. The inner cloud is built by committee and the outer cloud is built by a company that doesn't really want the inner cloud to be there. And maybe that's the complexity. It's the friction between those two worldviews and two methodologies for building clouds.
Right. It does go back to the OpenStack problem of OpenStack was very much cloud by committee. And for all its initial failings, OpenStack is still broadly used, especially by the telecom industry. And if you look at what's happening underneath with Red Hat OpenShift, it's just using OpenStack, Red Hat's implementation of OpenStack under the covers. So none of that went away, but all the complexity that you're talking about with Kubernetes all existed in OpenStack too, because it had Keystone and it had Nova and Cinder. And I'm going to forget like the 26 other sub projects for all the different components. We had that. Kubernetes actually did, I think, a better job of managing that complexity than OpenStack did.
OpenStack tried to do it all. Like, we'll provide you the compute, we'll provide you the networking, we'll provide you the storage. That's why it was a stack. Whereas first, you know, Docker was like, we're just doing containers. And then Kubernetes is like, we're just orchestrating those containers. That's why you have things like CNIs, because they're like, we're not touching that. We'll let somebody else figure it out. And so again, it becomes, you're trying to integrate a whole system. And that, I think, inevitably leads to complexity.
The VMware product is Tanzu.
Tanzu, thank you.
Yes, and I was close. It actually does, in Swahili, it means branches. And in Japanese, it means a container, which is why they chose that particular name.
Okay.
Cool.
Nice.
I remember things.
In an amazing way, both of you.
Your recall is healthier than mine, Ned.
It's full of pointless information, but yes. Okay, so I think we can maybe put a pin in Kubernetes. Is it going to stay complex? Yeah, probably. Yep. The other thing that you brought up, Kyler, was cloud repatriation. Mm-hmm. And Drew, I want to get your take on this. What do you think of cloud repatriation in 2024?
It's definitely a hot topic. You're hearing more chatter about it. And there's the occasional blog post of here's why we left, you know, AWS or Azure or whatever, and it's XYZ. And there's always a cost element to that. And I think it's good to see the chatter, because in cloud's early days, it was like, oh, we all have to be in cloud, get in cloud, blah, blah, blah. Do we have a business use for it? I don't know, but you know, the CIO read an article, so we all have to be there. So it's good to have some healthy debate about whether cloud is the right choice for a particular application. But do I see a mass repatriation from the cloud? No.
Kyler, what are your thoughts?
I swear that's the narrative, but I think it's more because it's incendiary. It gets engagement on social networks, where I live half my life these days.
Right. Just like serverless was rage bait for certain people. Like it still has a server. You can't call it serverless.
Anyone who loves Windows, I might have been, you know, the actor here too, of like saying, I don't want to manage Windows anymore. I want serverless to just take over. Let's go Linux.
No one wants to manage Windows Server, let's be clear here.
I mean, we've seen Blue Sky have like this incredible success of growing, what, 2,000% a day or something like that.
So and much, yeah.
In-house, it's been so cool to watch. And I got to read a sentence I haven't read in many years recently from their team. One of their engineers said, we're growing as fast as we can, but the servers are in the mail. It's been a while. It's been about a decade since I've read that sentence because cloud has been just so overwhelmingly dominant.
Yeah.
And I think it's more like finding the right tool for the job. We're starting to see that narrative happen because cloud is becoming this more mature platform. It's a mature option where it is a good fit for some tools. If you have incredibly bursty traffic, which almost no one does, by the way, but if you do, cloud is perfect for you. It can scale very rapidly, especially if your company's growing like bonkers. But if you have pretty flat traffic and you're not developing a product, like you're a mature business niche and there's not a ton of competitors for you, like if you're just running the thing, day two DevOps, running the thing, you know, in a data center is probably perfect for you. Like your overhead costs are probably quite a bit lower. Cloud is more of an enablement tool than it is a way to run things cheaply. You know, it's certainly not the way to run things the cheapest.
Definitely not. Yeah.
And that's, I think, where you're getting at there is if you're in a steady state where you don't have a ton of innovation and changes and scaling happening with you, then yeah, hosting your own stuff in your own data center or putting it in a colo where you're like buying and selling the hardware and managing some of it yourself. From a cost perspective, if that's what you're optimizing for, yeah, it might make sense. I think what sparked a lot of the conversation was there was an A16Z article published back in 2021 called A $1 trillion Paradox, the Cost of Cloud. And so they basically made the case, which is exactly the case you brought up, which is when you are initially scaling like crazy, experimenting, trying to find out what your application does, you don't even know what it does yet. You're trying to find market fit, right? The cloud is perfect for that. But when you achieve that steady state at some future moment, then moving stuff on cloud is going to make sense. And they brought up Dropbox, I think, because that's like the poster child for this. And more recently, DHH and his migration of stuff, though that's at a significantly smaller scale. I think despite all this cloud repatriation talk, what we're actually just seeing is a lot of hybrid cloud, where I'm going to move my steady state stuff back to a colo or on-prem, but there's still lots of stuff I use the cloud for, like CDNs. That's the cloud. I'm not going to build out my own CDN, you know?
Question for you both, with the whole post-Broadcom acquisition of VMware, if there was ever going to be sort of a target for sort of repatriation, it seems like VMware would have been an ideal candidate, but they burned a lot of bridges, I think, with the enterprise. So that also seems to me sort of like maybe an inhibitor, like, well, yeah, we might do less cloud, but what are we going to use for our on-prem solution?
Kyler, can you create a line chart for me of the top talkers on our Azure resources over the last week?
Well, I could. Just give me maybe 2 weeks to learn Splunk, KQL, graphic design. I'll have something to give you maybe next month. Or? Well, we could ask Kentik's AI and have results in just a few seconds.
Really? What else does Kentik do?
You know how cloud networking feels like this huge black box sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are these network egress fees? Is this huge traffic spike impacting page load times? Is this security policy blocking the right traffic?
Yeah, and not to mention, how do I show this dev team that they need to build caches locally to cut down our cloud bill?
Exactly. Kentik is cloud observability for network nerds. It puts all of that mysterious cloud networking data into context, and it has this super fast engine for analyzing and visualizing it.
So you're saying it gives you not just the ability to see the data, but also to understand the data.
You got it exactly. And our listeners can too at kentik.com. Oh, and here's that chart you asked for. Turns out the top talker was you, Ned.
Yeah. So there's other options out there for sure. Mm-hmm. Red Hat has been making a lot of hay about OpenShift and its ability to also use KubeVirt to run virtual machines.
Mm-hmm.
Proxmox had a shining moment in the sun where a bunch of people were migrating over to that. And there's a number of other solutions. What we're also seeing is that there's been no mass movement away from VMware yet.
Yeah.
A lot of that has to do with the fact that enterprises move slower and maybe they just negotiated a 3-year contract, so they're not going to be dropping it now, but it's going to take them 3 years to initiate and do that migration off of VMware.
Right.
So while we're not seeing a massive cancellation of contracts, what we'll probably see is 3 to 5 years from now, those who really got angry at VMware and decided to migrate off will finally do it. And those who just kind of like swallowed their pride and took the massive 200% increase in their bill, now that's just become common. Like, so the next contract negotiation won't be nearly as painful. And that's what Broadcom wants. They want the big customers who aren't going to kick a fuss and are just going to pay the premium that they're charging to run VCF.
Right. And who are also looking at sunk costs and all the training they've done, all the skill sets they've developed. It's not just about moving to a new platform. It's about the operators.
Yeah. The larger you are, the more expensive changes are. So eventually you get to this lock-in point where you can charge so much money and it still makes sense. Even at small scale, I think my QuickBooks has doubled in cost in the last year or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even really considering moving off of it because I just don't have time. So it's true at a very small scale too. I already know how to use the platform. I already know that it works for my needs. I don't have time. It doesn't build my business to think about moving the tools around. It's just cost management. So I'll just keep it. Yeah.
Like, I hate my bank. But the idea of moving off my bank is terrifying because of so many things that are hooked into it.
Yep.
It's not even the training thing. It's just like, I don't know what all touches the bank account, and I'd have to update all this paperwork in 20 different places. And I don't know, honestly, if the new bank's going to be all that much better than the old bank. And now that I've moved everything, it's going to be that much more difficult to move it again. So taking that from like a VMware perspective, maybe you hate VMware, but it's just too much work to move.
But do you hate mm-hmm. yourself more to make the move is the question.
Precisely.
A lot of pain now or a little amount of pain for a long time. It's hard to choose.
Yeah, I will say after the financial crisis back in 2008, we did move banks and my wife did all of that work and she was a trooper and it was bad back then. It's even harder to move now because everything's so tied in with automated payments and apps and so on that the lock-in is real. One thing that occurred to me in thinking about this topic about cloud is if you two have a sense about, are we starting to see the limits of data center growth from the hyperscalers, particularly around power and cooling? Like Microsoft is trying to get into nuclear power startups are out there because we're running out of energy here. Do you see that as maybe having a limit on just how far public cloud can grow in the future?
I think it's certainly going to strain our energy grids to run these hyperscalers, but also AI is just eating the world in terms of energy cost. It is ridiculous how much resources that consumes. And everybody wants it. I'm building a project myself to like enable my company to run AI queries for Gen AI like 150 times a day. So I think absolutely, yes. I think we're going to see this huge run on energy resources globally. And I don't know if it means like the post-apocalyptic future, but it probably means that energy costs are going to be more expensive. And hopefully sane governments will help us with rebates to get solar power and things like that, alternatives that are more localized. And we don't need a grid to get the energy to you. It's just local at your data center, at your house, wherever. Mm-hmm. I love some of the experiments that like Microsoft had done in Iceland with the like underwater data center that's down in these caverns. Like it certainly seems like the future, like that's what the future is an underwater data center or something, like an elephant flying above a cloud or something. It's just mystical. I love it.
I want that. I want the elephant flying above
the
cloud.
That's the future. That's not post-apocalyptic. That's the mystical future that I'm looking for.
I think what's interesting is the time scales that these hyperscalers have to work on, because they can't just be thinking about 6 months or a year from now mm-hmm. when it comes to capacity and building out new installations and dealing with energy. They need to plan out 5 to 10 years. And so the investments that Microsoft and AWS has also invested in nuclear, the investments they're making now, they don't expect a working reactor for 5 years, maybe 10.
Yep.
But they're recognizing that they need to do that now if they want to have that available in 5 years when they're building a facility. And Microsoft is even going so far, and I know you know this, Drew, to reopen Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania.
Yep. We have a literal stake here, Ned, you and I.
And for our younger listeners who don't recall, Three Mile Island had almost a meltdown.
Right.
And that's what it's best known for, at least in the Pennsylvania area. So the idea that they want to bring this back up to full operation, it should give everyone a little bit of pause.
For people of a certain age, Three Mile Island is shorthand for large-scale industrial disaster.
Yes. Could have been Chernobyl if things had gone a little bit worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's definitely something to think about. And the rise of AI is also concerning. Now, I will say that right now, the way that we're doing AI is we're using chips that were not specifically designed for AI workloads. They're GPUs. They're built to do like vector math. And I think we're going to see a lot of specialization in chip design to make AI processes more efficient because we can't continue to grow AI with the power consumption that's involved. That's going to become a limiting factor. So I think the software and the hardware is going to rapidly mature and become more efficient. I don't mean we're going to use less energy because we never use less energy. Right. I feel like there's a law about that somewhere, like Conway's law or something, that if you make the roads bigger, traffic will grow to use it.
Yep.
Maybe that's Jevons' paradox. I don't remember. There's like too many laws out there. But yeah, that is absolutely what's going to happen, is things will become more efficient, just like they have with the chips that Intel and AMD make. They've gotten more efficient. We just use as much power and get more compute out of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's the same kind of system at play where every 20 to 30 years we predict, you know, we're going to run out of food because we're growing at an exponential rate and our food production is not growing by. And so there's this prediction like, oh, we're all going to starve. That keeps not happening, right? There have not been mass starvation events globally because it means we require innovation and we require rebuilding some of the systems that those predictions are based on. And that's the exact same thing that's got to happen here. We cannot continue scaling hyperscalers and AI with the tools that we have today. We will reach a point where it can't keep going. So we need to reinvent it. We need new technologies. We need more efficient AI systems. Like, it has to happen because it's going to happen because it has to happen.
There's a really famous wager between, I think it was something Simon and Paul Ehrlich. Ehrlich was a biologist. He wrote the book about how we're all going to starve to death because we're going to run out of food. Mm-hmm. They made a wager in 1980, basically saying Ehrlich thought that we were going to run out of metals for making things, and that the price of like zinc, I think, was going to go like through the roof. And Simon said, no, people are going to find more efficient ways to mine for zinc, and we're also going to get better at using it in general. And so they made a wager about the price going up or down. And Simon won handily because we did exactly what he expected. We found other things that could be used in the place of zinc, and we also found more efficient ways to extract zinc. So the price went down instead of up. And that just seems to be a general trend that we can extrapolate for all things.
Yeah. And it doesn't just happen. So, you know, listeners, go invent stuff, go research this stuff, because people do it. You know, it's not just something that naturally happens. We don't naturally like discover a more efficient methodology or system. Like, people build it, companies build it. Go found a company, go make it better, because we have to, please.
Yes. Thank you. We can't just stand by and be like, well, progress just happens. It's like, no, the people make it happen.
Some ambitious electrical engineer out there, you know, in college, look at how much money NVIDIA is making. There's a big market there for you to eat into. You can come up with a better processing platform for AI.
Get a tenth of their market share and buy a continent.
Yeah, buy your own island.
All right, I think we have time for one more topic. And this one is the evolving role of a DevOps engineer. Kyler, you also have feelings about this one, and you're in the thick of it because you are a platform engineer, DevOps engineer. I'm not sure what your title currently is, but you're in the thick of it. So what's going on?
I'm not sure what my title is either. It changes. So I've made one up. Cloud security chick, because I don't know what I actually do all day. But when we first started this DevOpsy thing, like, everyone has a different understanding of what DevOps means. But when I first learned about it, it was just the intersection of development and ops. They build the bridges, they help the automation, enable development to make products, make stuff that makes us money, please. And as time has gone on, that center, that little intersection among the two circular pies, has just gotten bigger and bigger. And I think today it's both the pies. It's development and operations inclusive. And maybe there are experts at the very edges of those slices that just do development or just do ops, but I think DevOps is everything. DevOps is now all of operations, in my experience, and it's most of development. And I just think that can't continue. I just don't see it continuing. We have the same problem with information security, where a junior cybersecurity engineer is just not nearly as valuable as a senior. And what companies want is, well, I want like 10 seniors and I want no juniors. And that just doesn't happen because there's an ecosystem of training people up to get to these senior levels. Mm-hmm. You can't all be Netflix. Nobody can just all be Netflix and only have senior super engineers. Like, you have to be hiring this ecosystem of folks and training them up. And if you have to know a dozen tools or two dozen tools to run your tooling, to like actually make your product work and deliver value for your customers, then where do you get all these engineers and how much money are you going to have to pay them for them to learn 24 tools to make your product work? So I was hoping there would be this natural disincentive for companies to just have DevOps engineers own the entire stack. And that just hasn't happened in my experience. I'm very curious to see, y'all disagree with me, but shouldn't companies naturally be trying to break this into different verticals, you know, ops and dev, because it's cheaper?
Well, wasn't the whole point of DevOps to break down the silo between ops and dev because they assumed things would work better if these two groups were communicating instead of competing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we saw that when the role was kind of contained in the middle, that bridge, like they can do that bridge so well. But now we keep adding responsibilities to our DevOps engineers and they're just having to be more and more senior to be effective. I'm worried about that. Maybe that's just because the trend happened a long time ago and those folks are getting smarter and better and stronger and can do more. How do we get junior DevOps engineers? Where do they come from if we have to have seniors to make this whole thing work?
Yeah, I think this is a persistent problem across all of the domains in IT and probably every industry in that organizations want to hire expertise right away out of the gate. They don't want an apprenticeship period. They don't want people who have to spend time learning and need to be trained because if they invest money in training them, they might go somewhere else. That's been a persistent tension, I think, just in the industry. And maybe it's starting to reach a breaking point in DevOps because, as you mentioned, Kyler, that movement has matured. But we're seeing it in networking too, particularly as networking tries to adopt more automation, which means behaving in some ways more DevOps-y, becoming more comfortable with things like Git and Python and scripting and tooling and APIs, where sort of the current generation and previous, it was all CLI all the time. And maybe you were a little bit of a rogue and did some Python and stuff, but how do we train new generations and bring them into networking, but also at the same time, give them these new skills that they need? And it's a hard question. I just came from the AutoCon conference, which is about advancing the state of the art in automation in networking. But one of the things that one of the co-founders, Scott Raban, said in his keynote was that what we need to do is look for non-traditional sources of folks to bring them into the industry, regardless of, you know, what discipline or domain it is. And I think that applies to DevOps. I think it applies to networking. So that means things like community colleges, people doing job changes, whatever, having an apprenticeship system within your organization. But I think we are going to need to solve this problem ourselves. There's no like untapped source of senior devs out there waiting to come and DevOps you to nirvana.
I think companies are going to push you till you break.
Right.
If you're not being the squeaky wheel, then they will just continue to pile more roles and responsibilities on you until you cry uncle and you can't take it anymore. And that's when they'll stop, is when people put up a fuss and say, look, this is so far outside my remit. I'm not doing this, or I quit. Like, I'm going to go work somewhere else where I don't have to wear 16 hats and I only have to wear 12. There's no way to get around the multiple hat issue, just like multi-cloud. But at the very least, I can reduce the number of hats and be more efficient. So I think some organizations, and we had Katrina Genesco on earlier this year, and she started at Comcast and they had a very robust sort of training and onboarding process for junior DevOps folks. She was literally out of college. This is her first job. And she was overwhelmed by the number of tools and technologies that she had to learn. But they started slow and they provided continual support as she learned these things. That's a really good example of people doing it right. So I think what you're identifying, Kyler, is a really big concern that if we don't take that approach, if we're not helping these people who are just getting started in the industry ramp up and learn, then we're going to be in a pretty tight spot when people start retiring and leaving the industry. Some companies are doing that. I hope that more companies get the message. Honestly, the ones that don't are going to run out of people to hire. When their staff ages out or leaves because they're burned out, then those companies will crash and burn themselves. Because if you don't have someone tending to the infrastructure flock, it can only run for so long.
Well, maybe they're just betting AI will be able to step in and take over at that point.
That's not a bet that I'd be willing to make.
No, me neither.
I always think of I forget what type of car it was, but one of the autonomous taxis in San Francisco. And if you just put a cone on its hood, it wouldn't go.
I've heard people boxing them in, like putting cones around them, and then they're just stuck there and they wait. And so it's a way to just get them off the road.
Yeah. So if you're betting on automation and AI swooping in to replace your fleet of DevOps engineers, I refer you to the humble cone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that is going to do it for today. Drew, thank you for being on the show. Is there anything mm-hmm. you'd like to plug or mention?
We tossed Blue Sky in there lightly earlier. I have evacuated Twitter. I'm now all in on Blue Sky. So if people want to follow me there, and I encourage them to come along, the networking and IT community in general has just exploded on that site. And we probably have mm-hmm. to tip the hat to Kelsey Hightower, who put his foot down and was like, I'm here. I left Twitter. I'm all in on Blue Sky. And after that, I saw a million people just be like, Kelsey's here. All right. But anyway, at drewcm.bsky.social, come on over. It's fun. I also recently published a supernatural horror novel. It's called The Haunting of Edward Drake. If you're looking for a fun read, check it out.
Awesome, Drew. Thank you so much. And just to add on to that, Kyler and I are both on Blue Sky now as well. And mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I have left Twitter.
Me too.
Did you? I left a pinned post that says come find me on Blue Sky, just because I don't want anyone to swipe my handle, but I will no longer be posting or checking.
I have more followers on Blue Sky than I ever did on Twitter, and I was on Twitter for a decade, so it is hopping. Come on over.
Yeah, now's a good time to get in.
The water's great. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, Drew, for being on the show. And hey, dear listener, virtual high fives to you for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, we would love to hear about them. Hit either of us up on LinkedIn or Blue Sky, or submit some feedback at packetpushers.net/followup. You can find me, Ned Belvance, at nedinthecloud.com, and my amazing co-host, Kyler Middleton, blogging over on Substack. And we're both active on LinkedIn. Stop by, say hello. If you like engineering-oriented shows like this one, visit packetpushers.net/subscribe. You'll find Drew's shows, Packet Protector and Network Break, as well as new shows like Technically Leadership with Laura Santamaria or Total Network Operations with Scott Roban. Till next time, just remember that DevOps is awesome, and so are you.